Sponsorship of the KQED live audio stream comes from Xfinity Mobile, featuring customized wireless plans. Customers can choose unlimited, buy the gig, shared data, or a mix of both and switch it up anytime. Learn more at xfinitymobile.com.
From KQED in San Francisco and Public Radio International, it's Pacific Time. I'm Juan Ha. On today's show, the rising price of pork is upsetting Chinese diners, and it's a big concern for the Communist Party. And move over, MySpace. Facebook? Forget about it. A social networking site from South Korea is staking its claim.
It's very rare to find a website that looks very Asian, and it has kind of the cuteness factor.
Pacific Time, your passport to Asia and America. Welcome to Pacific Time. I'm Juan Ha. Outsourcing is a provocative buzzword these days. Debate continues about U.S. manufacturing and engineering jobs moving to countries where labor is cheaper. By one estimate, more than 500,000 jobs once held by Americans have gone overseas since 2000. But now, there's a new wrinkle. Think of it as reverse outsourcing. Large Indian and Chinese companies that have led the outsourcing trend are now setting up shop in the United States, especially in the South. Georgia's governor recently announced that one of China's largest heavy machinery companies will put its American headquarters near Atlanta. Susan Capiluto of Georgia Public Broadcasting reports.
There's plenty of room in the industrial park of Peachtree City, a planned community just south of the Atlanta airport.
The center of town is actually this intersection of Highway 74 and Highway 54. We are on this north side of town right here.
Ted Murphy runs the development office here. He points with his stick to a place on a giant map in his office.
In the main commercial area, retail area, is this avenues here. That kind of begins the industrial area just below that commercial area. This is a major office park close to
the industrial park already sports company affiliates from nine different countries, ranging from Japan to Germany. Now Murphy can add China to the list. It was with great fanfare that Georgia Governor Sonny Perdue recently announced the arrival of Sani Industries.
We are very pleased today to announce that Sani Heavy Industry, based in the Hunan province of China, has officially chosen Georgia to be home to its North American corporate headquarters, as well as a site of its first manufacturing facility in the United States.
That plant will be a $30 million investment by Sani. The company makes heavy equipment used at major construction sites throughout the U.S. Now it will assemble them here. The state of Georgia has kicked in a $900,000 grant, and Sani gets a $2.2 million tax credit for providing up to 600 jobs over the next 10 years. The move to Georgia is not just a monetary decision, says Sani President Wang En Liang through an interpreter.
It is actually more expensive to produce here.
Then why do it?
那你为什么要做这个投资呢?
因为这个美国的这个创新的文化比较好。Because
innovation in the United States is much better.
Experts say Asian companies looking for U.S. innovation favor the South, where land and labor are cheaper than in other parts of the country. Pat Murphy says the fact that Georgia is a right-to-work state, where labor unions are almost non-existent, was a huge selling point for Sani.
With the Chinese, it was fairly big because they are not used to unions. They have no history with unions the way they've been established in the U.S. And the fact that they could come and not be influenced or affected at all by the unions was probably very positive for Sani.
Sani was the latest in a handful of Asian companies in recent months to come to Georgia. In fact, foreign holdings are so plentiful here that already one in five Georgians has a job with a foreign-owned company. Governor Perdue says that's a sign of the time.
globalization will take place. We hear oftentimes about outsourcing. My goal is to replace every job that goes with two jobs coming in.
And Sani, says Pat Murphy, should fit right in. He says the 36,000 residents of Peachtree City will adjust to their newest neighbors.
The people won't have a problem because the Chinese company is prepared to have very competitive wages. One of the things that we have joked with the Chinese about is in China, they start every day with about 30 minutes worth of calisthenics. And that will probably be a shock to a lot of the labor force here in Georgia, where they're able to instill that camaraderie and exercise program with the American worker is yet to be seen.
Murphy says Sani's investment in Georgia will be closely watched by other Chinese companies and should bring more of them into his industrial park. Economists say it's a sign that a region where cotton was king at one time is now moving into global market manufacturing. For Pacific Time, I'm Susanna Capoluto in Atlanta.
Sani is the third Chinese firm to open operations in Georgia in recent months, and some big companies from India have made similar moves. Indian firms Wipro and Infosys make huge profits employing Indian engineers to crank out software for American firms on contract. Both recently announced they will begin hiring American programmers through new offices in the U.S. Jagdish Sheth is a professor of marketing at Goizueta Business School at Emory University in Atlanta. He's been following this trend of reverse outsourcing from India and China.
America is most attractive. The first key reason is cheaper dollar. And both countries are betting that their currencies will appreciate going forward, and therefore you are better off buying the asset now. Exports will become more expensive if your domestic currency is going to be appreciative. For example, Indian IT industry almost had significant compression of their profits margins because the rupee appreciated suddenly.
Now, even with the cheaper dollar, manufacturing and labor costs are a lot cheaper in China and India. So how does that pencil out overall for them to operate in the U.S.?
Yeah, that happens because the cost of labor, both in manufacturing as well as in services industries, is getting a lot cheaper as a percent of total inputs, mainly because we are automating. For example, the automobile factory of Sani in Georgia will be as automated as any other factory and will not have as many employees, which is mostly robotics. The American labor, surprisingly, is very productive labor. We enable a worker with more automation than most other countries. We give them lots of tools. If you just look at observe any manufacturing, a typical crane operator has enormous amount of tools given to the person to dig holes, construction industry, or factories for that matter.
Are there other compelling reasons why many of these international companies are attracted to southern states?
Yeah, they are attracted to southern states for two other reasons, in addition to economic incentives, which, by the way, is a key component. The first one has access to talent. In other words, there is a pool of people available in this country that they can, for example, Wipro's decision to come to Atlanta, Georgia, and start a new, 500 people to 1,000 people, they will ramp up because there is access from vocational technical training schools. Second major resource we are finding in America especially is that in America we have an enormous pool of talented people in the military, both at the sort of the military leader level. They're all excellent future leaders of corporations or enterprises, but also soldiers.
So are you seeing many former military personnel being picked up by these foreign companies that have set up there?
That is the intent.
And in terms of reverse outsourcing, how much of it is also that in India and in China you're seeing costs rise right now? I mean, you hear about, there's not enough talent there and they're really expensive and they jump around a lot and each time, they get a 25% pay increase.
You are absolutely right that in India and China, respectively, let's say India more for services and China, let's say, for more manufacturing, just as a stereotype, although both are into each other. the wages of both factory workers as well as professional workers or, you know, office workers is just skyrocketing. In fact, it is rising at 15, 18, 20% annual wage increases. Attrition rate is very high, which means as the employees, you have so many choices that you are jumping the ship from one company to the other.
So the price differential of operating overseas in Asia has become less?
In India today, the call center, voice-oriented call center, the attrition rate is more than 100% a year. You have to put training of these people for 6 to 8 weeks because that's the mandate by an outsourcing customer like Delta Airlines here or United Airlines or American Airlines for their call centers or utility companies or credit card companies. By the time you train these people, they have already left you.
You know, there's still a lot of debate over outsourcing here in the United States. Many American companies don't want their customers to know that they've outsourced some of their functions to firms in Asia. At the same time, many of these Asian companies that's, you know, who are leading the outsourcing trend have become multinational companies themselves. Mm-hmm. To what extent do you think are companies from India and China who are setting up business operations in the United States trying to build up goodwill and perhaps a better name for themselves?
There's no question that they are very conscious that this particular outsourcing could become an emotional political issue, just like illegal immigration becomes an issue or abortion becomes an issue, and therefore it will have an impact on them, at least short-term, if not a long-term impact, till the political winds change. So clearly they understand that, and they would like to somehow preempt that if possible.
Jagdish Sheth is a professor of marketing at Goizueta Business School at Emory University. Coming up, it's the year of the pig, and porking out in China has gotten a lot more expensive. You're listening to Pacific Time on PRI, Public Radio International. I'm Juan Ha. You've probably heard of Facebook and MySpace. The two web surfaces are leading the social networking craze in the United States, where friends and strangers view and comment on one another's personal websites. But those big-name sites are getting some surprising competition from South Korea. As Vanessa Hua reports, this new contender is winning over converts in America.
Megan Radke is logging on to SciWorld. We enter her virtual mini-home, which is decked out with sleek designer furniture and a pet cat, all selected by Radke. On another page, her mini-me, or an online representation of her, hangs out under starry skies at the beach. Radke surfs onto SciWorld at least once a day.
A lot of the things I could never afford, like a cabana room or whatnot, it's kind of like that second life phenomenon, I guess, that where you can like build an alternate reality for yourself.
SciWorld, which was founded in 1999, has 20 million users in South Korea. That's 40% of the country's population. The site expanded into China, Japan, and Taiwan, riding the wave of popularity of all things Korean in the region. About a year ago, SciWorld entered the U.S. market, where it attracted users like Radke, who is half Chinese and a quarter Japanese. SciWorld offers a place for users to sketch pictures, edit videos, and write in an online journal. Think of Second Life, YouTube, LiveJournal, Facebook, and MySpace all in one. The U.S. site has about 200,000 subscribers and attracted 470,000 visitors in July. That's tiny compared to the 19 million who surfed to Facebook and 61 million on MySpace, according to Nielsen Net Ratings. But size isn't everything. Radke used to visit MySpace, but she's given it up.
I really didn't like the look of MySpace very much, and though you can edit it to your taste a little bit, I didn't really like it, and also I kept getting invites from a lot of people I didn't like, even though I had it on like a private setting.
On SciWorld, she's joined music clubs focusing on J-pop and other music genres from Asia. She's also part of a design club, where other users from Japan and Korea can check out her work and comment on it.
You do see a lot of people who are interested in Asian things, but it's very rare to find a website that looks very Asian, and it has kind of the cuteness factor as well as the... there's just something about the design and layout, I think, of SciWorld now that it really does appeal to people who enjoy Asian visuals. So it appeals to my taste very strongly.
SciWorld USA's headquarters are located in downtown San Francisco. About 20 engineers, product managers, and marketers work from here to tailor the look of the site to American tastes. Kathy Yu, the company's director of marketing, explains the differences between the Korean and U.S. versions.
We did go through several sort of iterations of localizing the Mini-Me, where we tried to age up the look of the Mini-Me and make it more in style with sort of U.S. users. And the choices for the emoticons and clothing and hair choices are different as well as a lot of it is skin too, because in Korea it's a very homogenous population and there was only one skin color, where we have and we need to expand this further, but we do have this sort of different skin tones.
The site has found a following among Asian Americans, says Darian Patchen, senior director of marketing.
That makes sense if you think that there are over 20 million people in Korea who use the site, so it makes sense that they have friends in the U.S. that are also Korean, or they may work over here, or they may now live here, and they've then told their friends, and like any social network, that's how it grows, through friends of friends.
SciWorld USA wants to expand even more, though it's been a challenge.
It's almost a new mode of operating. What you have over there is almost a comparison to Google in terms of SciWorld's success, and to come over here, it's almost like starting over.
Analysts say the social networking giants in the U.S. can learn from SciWorld's success. For example, SciWorld offers the sale of virtual items to furnish mini homes and to give as gifts. They're payable in a currency known as acorns, which are worth about 10 cents in real money. In South Korea, $300,000 worth of digital items are sold every day. Larissa Hiort is a visiting research fellow at Yonsei University in Seoul. She studies mobile communication, gaming, and virtual communities in the Asia-Pacific region.
MySpace and their new owners were quite aware that, you know, they had a lot to learn from, say, something like SciWorld if they wanted to kind of keep that longevity. And if they wanted to keep and nurture one of the really important things, which is social capital. And the thing that MySpace looked at SciWorld and was really, really jealous about was the fact that SciWorld is able to make money from this social capital.
So to learn from each other, perhaps social networking sites should start to network with each other. For Pacific Time, I'm Vanessa Hua.
There's a lot of talk and worry these days about the crisis in the U.S. housing market and its impact on the broader economy. In China, there's similar worry, but it's about pork. The country's inflation leaped to its highest level in 11 years. That prompted the government this week to announce a freeze on prices for certain products. One of the culprits of China's inflation is pork and its rising cost. It's the meat of choice in China, and the poorest Chinese are the ones who miss their pork the most. Yuan Chan has more from Beijing.
Nimble chefs step up the pace as orders come in thick and fast at the Lao Man restaurant in Beijing. Red braised pork, fragrant shredded pork, mushu pork, these are just some of the popular menu items containing China's favorite meat. In the dumpling kitchen next door, Lao Man's cooks prepare more than 30 varieties of northern China's staple food. More than half of those contain pork. According to manager T, the restaurant gets through 50 pounds of pork a day just filling dumplings, and another 50 pounds for other dishes.
Food is the most important thing for most of us. People love meat, and pork is everyone's first choice. Why? Because it's fragrant, tasty, and nutritious. Whenever there's a celebration or festival, generations of families will gather and eat pork and feel really content.
It's little wonder, then, that China is the biggest global producer and consumer of pork, as this promotional trailer for the World Pork Conference, which opened in the Chinese city of Nanjing last week, attests.
In 2005, China had 50 million pigs on hand, 66 million pigs for sale, and produced 50.1 million tons of pork. On average, one Chinese had 59.2 kilos of meat last year.
It's the first time the biannual meeting has been held in China, and organizers from China's meat associations say it was highly fortuitous for the country to host the gathering during the Chinese Year of the Pig. It's less fortunate that this is also the Chinese year of high pig prices. In July, wholesale pork prices were up 75% from last year, with consumers paying an average of $1.60 a pound for leaner cuts, a hefty amount in a country where the average urban income is just over $1,000 a year. Mindful of pork's central status in the nation's diet and the psychological impact of price hikes, the government took swift action to ease concerns about the supply and price. In May, Premier Wen Jiabao visited pig farmers and supermarkets in Xi'an and pledged the government would go all out to ensure the supply of pork and keep it affordable, providing subsidies for pig farmers, giving pigs privileged access on all transport services, and tightening controls on corn exports. China even has strategic pork reserves, much like the American strategic oil reserves, and the premier said they'd be used if necessary. Such high-profile pronouncements from top Chinese leaders underscore fears that rising food prices may affect social stability. They also highlight a deeper concern about creeping Chinese inflation and its potential global impact. Meat makes up around 7% of China's Consumer Price Index, or CPI, basket. Last month, the basket had its steepest rise in more than 10 years. Officials point to two main reasons for the increase: the high costs of grain that pigs eat, and an outbreak of a disease called porcine reproductive and respiratory syndrome, or more popularly, blue ear. The official death toll from the virus is around 40,000 pigs, but Professor Wang Ruojun from China's Agricultural University says it's not the actual number of pigs killed that matters.
Because a lot of people, you know, afraid, you know, these kind of diseases, so they don't want to feed pigs anymore. China is mainly a production area based on the countryside pig production. We see backyard feeding. At least 70 to 80% of the Chinese pig are produced from this kind of family-based system. Once a lot of the Chinese farmers migrate to the city to find a job to make a relatively stable money, they would rather stay there rather than take the risk by the diseases, by the price fluctuation of the pig farming.
Wang says that in China's cities at least, pork is beginning to lose ground to other meats such as poultry, beef and fish. But for those who still love their pork, there is some good news. The wholesale price has dropped slightly for the last 2 months, although with the feast days of Mid-Autumn Festival and National Day just around the corner, prices can still be expected to remain high. For Pacific Time, I'm Yuan Chan in Beijing.
Pork has a special meaning for me. It saved my family's life. During the late 1970s, a certain kind of pork, cooked and shredded, commanded a premium price in the markets of Saigon. It's called jabaum, salted pork jerky that's finely shredded. It's portable, and it keeps well, and that was why it became a vital commodity, the food of choice for hundreds of thousands of Vietnamese who fled their homeland by boat. I was 6 years old when our family made the escape in 1979, along with 24 relatives. For our voyage, my mother made up a simple shopping list: rice to fill our bellies, sugar to give us a little energy, limes for vitamins, and of course the staple, jabaum. But you couldn't buy more than a meal's worth of shredded pork at a time, otherwise your neighbors and the police would become suspicious. And at that time, we were all prisoners under close watch inside our own country. So you purchased just a few grams of jabaum each day, hoarding it until you had several kilos for the journey. Having enough jabaum was just one of the many worries. For years, my grandparents, my aunt and uncle, plotted to escape, but their plans were foiled, and each time they wound up in prison. And if you did make it out to sea, you had to worry about the pirates. Poor Thai fishermen pounced on our desperation, stripping themselves of their own humanity. They became robbers, rapists, and killers. 3 times, they chased down our boat and threatened us with machetes. In the end, at least no one was murdered. And then there were the storms. Huge black waves hid the moon and stars. My mother shivers every time she talks about it, looking up at a wall of black water, holding her breath and praying that the wave's crest would retreat. Instead, the waves cascaded across the deck, swamping our crowded boat. I remember the quiet of that morning after the storm. We were stunned we were alive. Even as a child, I knew that. The rice was spoiled. My mother fed us jabom. It was soaked through with seawater, and it never tasted so good. And some final notes on what else is making news in Asia and Asian America. Thousands of Buddhist monks marched through the streets of Burma this week. They were protesting the military's use of violence to break up a recent rally over the soaring cost of fuel. During that initial rally, four monks were arrested and handled harshly. The monks' mistreatment has embarrassed the government since monks are revered in that country. Burma, which is also known as Myanmar, is ruled by a military junta. The top surviving leader of the Khmer Rouge regime was arrested this week in Cambodia. 82-year-old Nguyen Chia will be tried for crimes against humanity by a tribunal that's backed by the United Nations. Known as Brother Number Two, he played a key role in the deaths of 1.7 million Cambodians between 1975 and 1979, according to prosecutors. He's the second top Khmer Rouge leader to be arrested. The mastermind of the group, Pol Pot, died in 1998. And more than 50,000 lunchboxes given away by the state of California were found to contain high levels of lead. The lunchboxes were handed out by the California Department of Public Health to promote good nutrition. They were made in China. They're green canvas and were given out at health fairs. People who have the lunchboxes are advised to take them to a facility that accepts hazardous waste. It's time for us to say goodbye. Our theme music was composed by Anthony Brown with the Asian American Orchestra. Visit us on the web at kqed.org/pacific time. Got a story idea or a comment on something you've heard here? Email us, pacifictime@kqed.org. Our staff includes Nina Thorson, Wing Guiduk, Danny Bringer, Seal Muller, Susie Racho, Mina Kim, Helen Lee, Wang Pei, Michelle Lei, and Raul Ramirez. I'm Juan Ha. Thanks for tuning in.
Funds for the production of Pacific Time are provided by the Freeman Foundation, Matthews International Capital Management, a San Francisco-based advisor investing in the future of Asia since 1994, the Wallace Alexander Gerbode Foundation, and the KQED Campaign for the Future Program Venture Fund.
PRI, Public Radio International.